Our first presenter this afternoon is Dr. Rainer Lotz. Rainer Lotz is an economist and mechanical engineer by education, a retired civil servant who specialized in development aid, and a lecturer on political science. As a consultant and development bank manager, Dr. Lotz worked in the Near East, Latin America, Southeast Asia, and East Africa. He is the compiler of more than 50 LP and CD anthologies of historic recordings, author of more than 200 articles in scholarly journals, and has more than 90 monographs to his credit. He is also a contributor to several dictionaries and encyclopedias, including the New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians and the Oxford Companion to Black History. Current projects include the German National Discography, of which 24 volumes have been published to date, the Biographical Dictionary of Entertainment in Germany, and German 78 RPM Record Labels and Companies. Rainer has given numerous presentations at ARSC conferences and is a recipient of the ARSC Lifetime Achievement Award. His presentation today is titled Cross the Water Blues, Musical Archaeology in Imperial Germany. Won't you please welcome Rainer Lotz.
Thank you, Gary. Welcome. Thanks for coming, and thanks for cutting your lunch break short. Oops. You all know that I'm not an English speaker, so please bear with me and my very heavy German accent. My English may be different from yours, so if you don't understand what I want to convey, just ask and I'll try to translate. My topic today is the archaeology of jazz. And it seems that jazz sprang up all of a sudden. It appeared out of nowhere. Nobody knows why and when and how. And within no time at all, it spread around the world. And this phenomenon is really what has intrigued me all my life. And as a record collector, I tried to find out whether more could be found out about the prehistory of jazz. Assuming that jazz also has black roots, I asked myself, how were Europeans first exposed to black music, music by African-American performers, and has there been perhaps any cross-fertilization between the two groups, and not only Europeans, but also other cultures? And we must assume that the prehistory of jazz dates back to the 19th century, and thus at a time when there were no or hardly any sound documents. And apparently there is very little factual information, I have to be careful here, about the origins of jazz and it opens the door to a lot of speculation, of course. Most of the early authors of jazz, the history of jazz, and the first authors of jazz discography, strangely enough, were Europeans. And those Europeans had no first-hand knowledge of the places where it possibly all began. They have never been to Sedalia in Missouri or New Orleans, in Louisiana, or Clarksdale, Mississippi, or Chicago, in Illinois. So their only contact with the music must have been through imported records. And records they found in Europe during the 1920s and 1930s. And if we examine the record catalogs of the time, there were hardly any black American musics represented. In Britain and in Germany, and thus in the rest of Europe, American jazz was represented almost exclusively by now mostly forgotten white bands like Ed Kirkaby or Vincent Lopez or Mike Markle or Harry Reaser or Ben Selvin or Sam Lennon. And the hottest thing that was issued in Europe was probably Paul Whiteman. So authentic hot recordings by, say, Louis Armstrong or Fletcher Henderson or other such groups never made it to the catalogs. And the few that were offered in catalogs, apparently never sold, because I have never, ever found any of those records during 50 years of collecting, although some were really listed in the catalogs, so presumably they could have been bought. And the situation was, of course, even more dramatic with regard to blues. American commercial companies had released about 7,000 double-sided blues and gospel records involving some 1,200 artists. If we add the archival recordings made by the Library of Congress, we have an estimated total of 22,000 blues titles recorded in the United States prior to, say, 1940. Of those available in Europe, there are 50 out of 22,000. And those 50 were not available at any one time, but over a period of 20 years. So how those early writers dealt with the subject matter is really mind-boggling. They must have been very clever and must have relied not only on records available through the record companies, but imports they did themselves or contacts with friends in America. Now, today we take it for granted that just about every blues record ever recorded in the United States is readily available on CD and thus available for research. But that was not so during the 1920s and 1930s, as I tried to explain. But now we do have access, thanks to the efforts of an Austrian, Johnny Part, whose dream was to put into print and maintain permanently all blues records ever produced, and he founded his document record company, and he did achieve that. So at the time when the early writers wrote about jazz and tried to figure out the prehistory of jazz, they relied on records available to them. And they had completely forgotten, even if they had known about it, that there was there were sound documents and recording formats, recording technologies during the time before the First World War and before the turn of the century, such as piano rolls, phonograph cylinders, mechanical music box instruments, and the like. So therefore, if it wasn't on records, it didn't exist for them. Now, some of you may be surprised that when I tell you that German musicians played music in the United States, they entertained both black and white audiences from the mid-1800s, especially from the 1870s to the First World War. So vast parts of Germany were very poor, overpopulated. People could not survive in agriculture because only the firstborn son would inherit the farm. So the others had to look for other job opportunities. They would become a priest or join the military, and some became itinerant musicians. So one of our biggest exports really were musicians who earned the living in places outside Germany. And that is particularly true for the remote areas, the mountain areas of Germany, where you could really talk about a musician's belt. And this is made visible, really, by the coats of arms of many of those little villages and cities, because you will see always the combination of an agricultural theme and a musical theme. So what I'm showing now is the coat of arms of Hohenöllen. I mean, that is a little place which 100 years ago only had some 400 inhabitants, 300 of whom were musicians. And since they worked abroad, you can see here where they worked. Most went to England, but the second largest group of itinerant musicians went to the United States. And in the United States, of course, they had to deliver what the public wanted to hear, the latest music, the latest dances. And I have been to local history museums in those little hamlets and checked the part books. And this is an examination of the part books that may be difficult to read for you from the back of the audience, but you will see that they had the complete selection of dances, and of those, only 4% were what interests me most, cakewalks and ragtimes and two-steps and things like that. But 4% may seem to be very little, but actually this survey stretches from the 1870s to the First World War. So ragtime and cakewalk, as I will explain later, only popped up during the very last years of the century. So 4% in the total represents maybe 40% in the years between 1905 and 1914. So, believe it or not, I have been able to prove that those ragtimes and cakewalks by both black and white composers were performed in the United States. And here you have a photograph for which I have no background information at all. All I know is that it shows musicians from another very, very tiny place called Jettenbach. You can forget the name immediately, I mention it. At that time it had less than 900 inhabitants. But what is interesting here is that you see the scattered musicians among a group of what appears to be prison inmates or a work gang and some other audience. How this picture was taken and why and where escapes me. I would give my left arm to find out. Very strange indeed. And again, the people who are shown on that last photograph came from a village which had this coat of arms. Again, you see the lyre and grain. So agriculture and music were the mainstays of those little hamlets in Germany. Now, my next coat of arms is another place, very tiny place in Germany. The name is Mackenbach. Now, those of you who served with Uncle Sam or for Uncle Sam may actually have lived there, because this little hamlet of Mackenbach is right next to the fence of the Ramstein Military Air Base, the U.S. Air Force headquarters for Europe. So it is in a very remote area of Germany. And another band from that village returned to the United States even after the First World War. So the tradition continued. And this band here is called Bill Henry and his Headliners. His Headliners. Now, the real name of that group is known. It's Heinrich Jakob, very good German name. But as you can see, they must have been competent musicians, but they had not a good grasp of English. So for a vocalist, they used a local. And I'm not sure whether you recognize him. It's none other than Frank Sinatra. That may have been his very first job as a professional singer. And he worked for an itinerant German band somewhere in the United States. Now, those German musicians who did not leave their villages earned their living, if they were not itinerant musicians, as home workers. So in some of the mountain areas of Germany, those home workers produced mechanical music instruments. And among those are, again, a lot of cakewalks for export purposes, but mind you, ragtime and cakewalk were also very popular dances in Europe and Germany, for that matter. So those people were not illiterate. They could read and write music, and they knew how to arrange music for mechanical instruments. And look at this. This is a metal music box record. And you notice, well, you don't, but the dark spots are actually little holes where pieces of metal have been punched up so that it stands upright. And when that disc is turned, the pieces of metal that stand up will strike the a comb and produce sounds. So this, you will notice that this is in German, in English, and in Russian. So it was exported worldwide. And what you see here is the Brooklyn Cakewalk. And it had a German title, and I will explain that later. So in actual fact, this is, although it may be completely unknown to you, the most often recorded cakewalk of all times, anywhere in the world, I mean, in the whole world. And the strange thing here is that when talking about cross-cultural influences, it is named after Brooklyn, which is a formerly Dutch hamlet in New York. It is composed by an Englishman, and it is dedicated to an Australian variety dance a pair, the Brooklyns, the Permans, and it is therefore often known as the Permans Brooklyn Cakewalk. And in Germany, lyrics were added to that, which relate to a fraud scandal. So there was a gentleman who went bankrupt, pocketed the money, and disappeared in his car with his girlfriend. And in 1905 or 8, there weren't that many cars on the streets of Germany, so he was caught immediately. And there was this topical song, Schorschel, ach, kauf mir doch ein Automobil, means, please, George, buy me an automobile, and we get away from Hamburg to the city of Kiel. So it rhymes. And I'll play you the, could you play the first track, please? That version from the metal disc. Metal disc, you can hear a cakewalk which was composed in 1895 by an Afro-Caribbean, a very, very well-known variety artist by the name of Bert Williams. And he dedicated his cakewalk to what may have been the greatest of all cakewalk dancers and the first who appeared in an evening dress on stage in the United States, Dora Dean and Johnson and Dean, Charles Johnson and Dora Dean. And this cakewalk was entitled the Dora Dean Cakewalk. So we just listen to that. Why do I expose you to that? The point I want to make is that there are a lot of cakewalks and ragtimes which have never been recorded on any other media. The Dora Dean cakewalk, for instance, was not recorded on the piano roll. It was not recorded on phonograph cylinders. It was not recorded on flat disc records. Having said that, I must immediately correct myself, because it was indeed once recorded on a very obscure American record, but they used another name for that. And here you have a blackface entertainer who used that tune, which was re-christened or renamed Ma Angeline. And the composer on that is identified as one Charlie Sidney O'Brien. And indeed, the published sheet music is a word-for-word and a note-for-note theft of the original composition by that black composer, Bert Williams. And he just replaced Dora Dean by Ma Angeline, which still rhymes. So Bert Williams went to the courts, and the judges decided that it was indeed his song, and it was stolen from him. But he was not entitled to copyright. So why not? Because the subtitle of his composition, which was in print, was Dora Dean, the Hottest Thing You Ever Seen. So they ruled that is obscene, and obscenity cannot be copyrighted. So what did Bert Williams do? He put out another sheet music and called it The Sweetest Gal You've Ever Seen. Now, I now play you another ragtime piece. You all recognize this. It is Scott Joplin's masterpiece, The Entertainer. We all know it today, but it was unknown to the first authors of jazz because The Entertainer, again, was never ever recorded on a 78. So the only way you could listen to it was either play it yourself from sheet music or listen to a music box. So we can thus draw the conclusion that Europeans knew how to perform black music, they knew how to perform it live, and they knew how to arrange it for syncopated mechanical music formats before the end of the last century. And by the time the early writers got interested in the prehistory of jazz, the memory had faded, and for that reason, I think some of the books have to be rewritten if you accept the notion that Cakewalk and Rags are one of the roots of jazz music, which can be disputed, but this is certainly my belief. Now, mentioning Scott Joplin's Entertainer Rag is my excuse to draw your attention to another interesting aspect of cross-cultural fertilization. For more than 100 years now, historians, musicologists, etymologists, and performers have speculated about the musical and etymological origins of rag and ragtime, until my good friend Karl-Gerzo Heide, a German researcher, suggested a plausible solution of the riddle, and he published that 4 years ago in 2005. He investigated a statement by rag pioneer Will Marion Cook. Will Marion Cook, a black composer and orchestra leader and violin player who got some of his education. He received some of his education in Germany, by the way. And Marion Cook, attended the Columbian World Exhibition at Chicago. in 1893. And at that time, one of the most popular attractions at the Midway Pleasance, which was an entertainment alley on the exposition grounds, was entitled The Streets of Cairo. And besides the Street of Cairo, there were other places where Oriental music was performed, and not only Oriental music, but Oriental belly dances, or as Will Marion Cook described it, the peculiar music of the muscle dance. Such belly dances had certainly been performed on American stages and in circuses and tent shows, etc., for decades and decades. But on this occasion, and with much publicity, the Chicago event was visited within a few weeks by some 27 million Americans. And I have been told that this is about the equivalent of half of the American population at the time. So one of the visitors was indeed Will Marion Cook, and he wrote, "It is worthy of note that after that time, the popularity of rag grew with astonishing rapidity and became general among Negro pianists." In order to understand what happened, let us look at some of those photographs. This one is from a German language book about the Columbian Exposition. We see here a typical scene from one of the entertainment places where Oriental musicians and Oriental dancers would perform. Here is another close-up of a group which was imported from Egypt or from Tunisia. There were people from all over the Orient, the Near and Middle East, performing on that occasion. So why am I mentioning this? Because those people were from North Africa and they spoke Arabic, of course. And when they introduced their performances, they must have announced the dances with the name used in Arabic, and in Arabic, a dance is raqs. It's not a plural S, it is the word raqs. Raqs means dance, and in particular, belly dance. So we have here a suggested etymology of the US vernacular word ragtime. So although ragtime is certainly, without any doubt, an American music, it shows striking similarities with the asymmetric accentuations of the melody, and some dances of the ragtime era follow patterns of Oriental dances, later also known in the US as the hoochie-coochie. So in 1896, one of the most famous performers at that time, she was known under the name of Fatima. Fatima was filmed by Edison, and the film is still at the Library of Congress. I wonder why they didn't show it to us, because it has no sound. But this is Fatima to the left on the original footage, and on the right is the sanitized version put out, and her bosom and her hips are covered by grids so to obscure the view. So, and Fatima, by the way, is known to have performed at the Ragtime Festival in St. Louis in 1905 or 1904. So the exposition ended in late 1893, and I don't think it is a coincidence that the first ragtime composition, which most people now agree is Irving Jones' Pasuma La Dance from 1894, was published only half a year after the exposition closed its doors. Now, coming back to American, Black American, African American performers, I must say I tip my hat and I bow my head to Tim Brooks, and also to the Archaeophone people for having done absolutely magnificent research on that theme. Now, I also did some investigation myself, and one of the performers that I have published about was a very obscure lady by the name of May C. Hyers. And I don't know whether you can see it. It says, May C. Hyers, one of the Hyers sisters. Now, the Hyers sisters were, during the 1870s, one of the most well-known, if not the most well-known, girl duet performing opera operatic songs, arias, and they never could make it into the opera houses because they were black. So they traveled small and medium towns all over the United States, one night, as we would say today, and in later times they also had, they joined forces with a minstrel show, and this advertisement for a very obscure company, the Kansas City Talking Machine Company, dates from 1898, and the catalog for this company lists about 50 cylinders by Macy Hayes, and this the range covers the entire range of what was expected from a minstrel company, operatic arias up to hot coon in Memphis or whatever. So ballads and love songs, everything was in there. Not one single copy of any of those cylinders has been found. If they could be found, they would be the very first recordings by a black American ever, whether male or female, 1898. Now, one of the reasons why we can't find them might be that at that time all phonograph records were one-off performances. So if you have a list of songs that the Kansas City Music Machine Company, in this instance, would offer to the public, if they received an offer, then the artist would be called into the studio before the recording horn, record just once that title, which will then be expedited and sold to the customer. So it might have been that this was just a list of things that they could offer if they were ordered, but we can't be sure that they were ever ordered. Now, I have published about this lady, and something happened, which always happens. I had just published it when I got a letter from a lady who said she is the grand-grand-grandchild of Macy Hayes. And she alerted me to the fact that she was not one of the Hayes sisters, but indeed their stepmother. So she married the father of the Hayes sisters, but cashed in on the popularity of the original Hayes sisters, and that is how she is announced here on that flyer. It's just an excerpt from a large flyer. Now, and she also, we met here at Washington, at Georgetown, a couple of years ago, in 2007. And then she told me the family lived in the same house for the past 80 years or so, and they just moved a year before we met, and they moved out of the house and threw away everything they had in there. And if they had any phonograph cylinders, she wouldn't have recognized them, what it was. Especially wax cylinders after 100 years don't only look moldy, they are moldy, and you don't want that in a new house. So if they survived, they are now gone forever. So, but what she saved are some theatrical photographs, large size photographs. You know, they were pinned outside the theaters or the circus tents or whatever. And to the right is Macy Hayes, the recording artist. To the left is her daughter, Bohee. Now, Bohee is a very strange name for a girl, and why she was called Bohee, I will tell you later. So, in 1879, the Daily Nevada State Journal reported from Reno, "This is positively the last appearance of the Hayes sisters previous to their European tour." Uh-huh, I said, oh. But I have no evidence that tour ever took place. But one thing is sure indeed, African Americans did tour Europe, and they came in great numbers. So African American performers were a stable factor in the European entertainment scene and industry, if you want to call it that, from the 18th century. And There were very strong socioeconomic reasons, which I don't have to explain to you, for black Americans to leave their home country. So slavery was abolished in 1865. The Ku Klux Klan was established 2 years later. and the terrible 90s when public lynchings were announced in newspapers just as a picnic must have meant a difficult time to many black Americans, especially in the southern states. So what opportunities did they have? They would move away. They would move from the south to the north, and they would jump a boat and work as a stoker, whatever, and make it to Europe. And while poor Germans migrated to the United States to work as itinerant musicians here, the poor black Americans traveled to Europe to work as itinerant musicians and performers there. And they worked in as instrumentalists, as orchestras, as dancers, as musical clowns, as theatrical performers, as minstrels, etc. So I checked one German theatrical weekly magazine, Der Artist, which was a magazine for German artists on the theatrical circuit, and in one year, the year 1896, I found references ad personam, people named by name, for more than 100 black Americans performing in German variety theaters and beer halls, etc. So if those people were named in a magazine which was really written for German performers, that must have been the tip of the iceberg. And indeed, some arrived in large companies. Here we have Footes Minstrels from 1891. They toured with the African Character Company, the African Character Concert Company, and they arrived in Germany in 1891. When the troupe broke up, many remained in Germany, and they traveled, they continued to travel all the way from Tangier in North Africa to Siberia, really, because at that time, nobody needed a passport except when you traveled to Russia. Anywhere else in Europe and North Africa and the rest of the world, you didn't need a passport unless you specifically asked the State Department, in this case, to have a passport for your personal identification. But it was not needed to cross the borders. Now, another company was, it must be a company well known to you or those that are interested in black music history, John W. Isham's Octoroons. They came in 1897. Another very important group came in 1903. They performed In Dahomey, the first black musical, which was performed first in New York, then went to Europe. That company, that black company, numbered 81 black performers. 81, an absolute incredible number. And again, when that company broke up, many of the ranks stayed in Europe. But apart from them, here we have another typical picture of a group that toured Europe and how they were advertised in Germany, for instance. And then another aspect. Many of those that remained in Germany married German girls or British girls or white girls. And those blacks could never hope to return to the United States, so they had to stay in Germany and continue touring there. And I have found many, many such examples. I collect postcards and some other such images. And those black and white couples, and they were actually advertised as such on the theatrical stage. Black and white was a common stage performance that people expected to see at the variety houses. So we have racially mixed duets long before John Hammond started his much talked about Carnegie Hall concert in jazz during the 1930s. So considering the vast number of African Americans that toured Europe, it would not be surprising, I thought, if they did cut cylinders and made records. And they did, and indeed they did. And one of the first team to perform were the two brothers, Bohee. And Bohee, that's the name. Those brothers, banjo players, who taught the King of England to play banjo, by the way, and they made, after they moved from St. John's in Canada to Boston, the center of banjo making, to Europe, they stayed there. But before they left for Europe, they were members of the minstrel troupe which traveled with the Sisters Hyers. And that is, I'm quite sure, the reason why one of the Hyer sisters was called Bohee with first name. So I won't go into the details of the career of the Bohee brothers, but there were others as well. They may have been the first, but there were others as well. Here is a label, very, very strange label by a gentleman by the name of George Hampton. Now, George Hampton came also to Europe as a member of Indahome, the troop I have already mentioned, and decided to stay in Europe for the time being. He was brought up in Minstrelsea. He was also with Bert Williams and George Walker. And in the Indahome company, he met a young girl, Laura Bowman, and they became husband and wife, or at least they had a common law marriage until they returned when the First World War broke out, and he died very soon after that. Now, this company toured widely in Europe, and Pete Hampton actually did not only record this one disc. He recorded more than 150 phonograph cylinders and gramophone records. And I published about him in an obscure Australian magazine, which never made it beyond issue number one. But it had sufficient readers to alert the rest of the world to look out for Pete Hampton records. And nobody would have picked it up before, because no names are not endeared to collectors. 5 minutes only. Oh, yes, dear. So I have to cut everything very short now. In a minute, we hear one title recorded by Pete Hampton, and that is That Mouth Organ Coon, his own composition. And I consider this to be one of the most important records ever made with regard to Black American recording history. So it has an interesting ragtime introduction on the piano. Then all of a sudden, he doubles the tempo. The piano accompaniment, probably an Englishman, gets into a frenzy. He really gets out of control. And right in the middle of the performance, Hampton abruptly takes out the tempo and he switches to harmonica. Hence the title Harmonica Coon, or that mouth organ Coon. And he quotes, of all titles, The Last Rose of Summer. Why? Because he had to perform what the people knew, but he performed in a way which was completely different from what von Flotow would have used in his opera. And he performs it at such a breakneck speed that it is hard to believe that he played the harmonica with his nose. So, and while doing this, he stomps his feet, he shouts, it's a truly astounding performance, and I still get goose pimples, although the recording quality is very poor.
That Mouth Organ Coon by the composer Mr. Pete Hampton, Edison Bell Records. I feel just as happy as can be. For style and execution, you will find my equal to you. And if you keep your eyes on me, you'll see just what I'll do. When I am playing, you'll hear them saying, he is that mouth organ fool. You'll see them prancing to the music, so entrancing. I'm happy when I play this tune. When I am playing, you hear them sing. He is that mouth organ fool. You see them prancing to the music, so entrancing. I'm happy when I play this tune. Thank you.
So I'm just about halfway through my presentation, so I show you some of the things I would have talked about and explained. And
can we get an encore after dinner?
Why not?
Can you do it after?
Yeah, you got to do the rest of it.
Okay.
Yeah. You traveled a long way. You should finish later.
And I just this one here. This is Josephine Morkashani. She was announced as the Creole female baritone. And for a while, she appeared with a Native American Sioux partner. So I assumed her to be a Red Indian as well. And she was always noted in the theatrical press for her very deep voice. And the reviewer said or hinted that she was really male impersonating a girl. And I assumed that because she is also a recording artist, that she was the first female drag black artist to record. And she did not only record, but she also made films. So I published about her. And to my utmost embarrassment, of course, the moment I published, I got mail and from the grandson of her, she got married and got children. And this was really very embarrassing. But in spite of that, the family shared with me this catalog, the only known catalog. This is a still of one of the three movies she did. And the titles she recorded for Sound Movies. Those were movies with synchronized discs to go along with them. So, and one last title I must bring.
We're out of time.
We're out of time. Okay. I'm flexible, except I can't keep myself short, so I can't keep time. But who knows?
I have no idea, but I know that we're already behind and we have to move on.
Okay, so.